I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show on Juneteenth. Today we have two segments from the Master Gardeners of Cornell Cooperative Extension for Green in Columbia Counties. We'll hear from Heidi Bach from the Columbia Land Conservancy on the Trekking the Trail segment as she explores Borden's Bond near Chatham. And David Chinnery from the Cornell Cooperative Extension in Rensselaer County talks about turf issues and the best ways to care for and improve lawns. Plus, we will hear the WGXC Congressional Report with the news from the past week from the representatives of the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st Congressional Districts. And the show will include an excerpt of Catskill's Amy Rigby performing on a live WGXC broadcast June 16th from the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. Stay tuned. It all begins after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Lance Treadwell from Albany, New York. You're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre.
Perfect.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Christian Swenningson of Stuyvesant, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Monday, June 19th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Joshua Solomon reports in the Times Union that since the COVID-19 pandemic, the public has had less access to its state capital and the lawmakers that represent them in Albany. State Constitution says, quote, the doors of each house shall be kept open, except when the public welfare shall require secrecy, unquote. But these days, the doors of the state capitol are often locked. Georgina Parsons, a spokesperson for the Office of General Services, which oversees operations at the capitol, admits that the State Street and Washington Avenue entrances that were once open to the public now often are not. Parsons said, quote, OGS will be working with the state police to develop a plan to inform the public about how to access the Capitol when some entrances are locked out of necessity, unquote. Parsons did not explain when exactly that necessity to lock the public out of the Capitol began. Both Governor Kathy Hochul and her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, promised their administrations would be the most transparent in state history. Former Assemblymember Jack McKenney, a longtime historian of the Capitol, said, quote, it's so sad that this extremely valuable resource we have isn't found in some way to be readily available to the public, unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. William J. Kemble reports in the Daily Freeman that the Woodstock Library's Drag Story Time and Sparkle Party on June 17th was packed with about 150 children and the same number of adults during 90 minutes of storytelling. The library's board of directors got three complaints about the event beforehand and held a public forum with the board voting to go ahead with the event. Only three people protested at the event, and only one would give their name. Town resident Tom Jenkins said, quote, the people who are allowing this have to separate education and the art of the drag queen. I'm not anti anybody, but when it comes to grooming our children and putting the sexuality of children on the line with a drag queen who little kids wouldn't understand, I don't get it. It's entertainment for adults to see it, to appreciate it and applaud, but a little child is very, very confused. And parents who are bringing their kids here ought to go to a psychiatrist, unquote. parent Amy Braden disagreed, saying, quote, "This is good because they can ask any questions they want. And as someone who is not gay, trans, or has any interest in being anything other than a straight, boring mom, this is a way to work on acceptance and letting my son know that they can live in a world with differences," unquote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. There are primary elections for local offices this month, with voting taking place from June 17th to June 27th. In Greene County, there is only one primary election. Republicans in New Baltimore decide between two candidates for highway supervisor, Robert P. Van Etten and Alan W. Van Warmer. In Columbia County, the Chatham Future Party has an uncontested primary in the northern Columbia County town. New Lebanon, Republicans choose between Peter McCagg and Jeffrey Weinstock for highway superintendent. There are also Democrat primary elections in all five of the city of Hudson wards. June 17th is also the last day to register to vote in the primary. June 12th is the last day for the Board of Elections to receive an application by mail for an online primary ballot. Read more about this story and the other stories on the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, June 19th. We are 46.5% of the way through the year. There are 2 days left until the summer solstice, which means we're about 2 weeks away from the start of hot summer. So far, what that means is for all the things growing out there, it's generally summer conditions, but the heat has not actually arrived yet. If you have any questions or comments, just toss me a good old-fashioned email at weather@wgxc.org. Alright, local early morning temperatures range from 48 degrees in Medusa to 53 in Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 61 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium. Only trees left, still making pollen look like hickory. If you're suffering now, it's probably because of all the grasses. Dew points in the upper 50s might make it feel humid for some, especially if the air isn't moving around. We see a high of 79 degrees at 3 p.m. Around that time, rain chances roll through the area, disappearing by dark. Overnight, we see a low temperature of 58 degrees, kissing the dew point, making sure tomorrow morning feels kind of sticky. And that's a heads up because a low chance for thunderstorms show up in the afternoon. We see a high of 77 degrees at 3 p.m. Overnight is dry, hitting 58 degrees. Wednesday sees a partly cloudy high of 80 degrees. Thursday, little warmer, hitting 82. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:20 a.m., low tide at 11:19 a.m., high tide again at 5:02 p.m., and low tide once again at 11:11 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 70.5 degrees, and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 8:20 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:15 a.m. Looking way up, we see sunspot 3335 popped off yesterday, causing some radio blackouts, and today is focused even more in our direction, so anything radio-based could suffer some random glitching. Plasma winds today will be average at 412 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, with fair conditions across the board overnight. There are no chances of aurora tonight. The current sunspot number is 133. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
What's the most important issue?
Getting back to the basics of teaching children, not teaching them critical race theory.
And what is critical race theory?
Well, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it because I don't understand it that much, but it's something that I don't, what little bit that I know, I don't care for.
And what have you heard that you don't,
well,
that you
I'm
don't
not,
like?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have that much knowledge on it, but okay. It's something that I'm not, that I don't care for.
Next, we hear the first two songs that Catskill's Amy Rigby played on her performance at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill on Friday, June 16th. It was broadcast live on WGXC. Anthony Kuzniski opened for Catskill's Amy Rigby, and here are the first two songs she played.
Everybody here? Everybody ready? I don't think I've ever said that in my life. To play in the town where we live, so this is a treat. Although, luckily we're going out of town in the morning, so we don't have to face anybody for coffee and be embarrassed. In 1916, he
took a bullet to the head. They all thought that he was dead, but he surprised them. In 1981, I withstood a similar attack. I got hit, but I came back, and it keeps happening. I'm like Rasputin. I'll get back again.
That was Catskills' Amy Rigby from a live broadcast on WGXC performing at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill on Friday, June 16th.
Welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our conversation today is with David Chinnery, Rensselaer County's Cornell Cooperative Extension Horticultural Turf Management Senior Resource Educator. Wow, that's a mouthful. David is the go-to guy for many of the surrounding counties and is in demand as an instructor for the Master Gardener Volunteer Trainings. David, how long have you been involved in the Cooperative Extension? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your history and also kind of your interest in turf management.
Well, thank you for having me here today. I go back to 1989 when I started working for Cornell Cooperative Extension in Westchester County. And at that time, I did all sorts of horticulture programs, and I wanted to move upstate. So the job in Rensselaer County came open in 1996. It was a turf grass position. It was regional. I didn't particularly like turf grass, but I said, I want to move. And I came up here and I adapted and learned turf grass. So now I am a turf grass person, and I'm not really regional anymore, but I certainly help out the other Cooperative Extension counties and Master Gardener programs.
Could you define what you mean when you say turf grass? It's probably obvious, but you're using that kind of as a term. So what does it exactly mean?
Well, that's a good question too, because I remember giving one of my first lawn talks for an hour. I talked about turf grass and lawns. And then at the end of it, a lady in the front row raised her hand and said, "What is turf grass?" So it is good to define. What we mean by turf grass is anything that we mow and we walk on. That's how I look at it. So that includes lawns, sports fields, utility areas, golf courses, those types of areas where we're growing grasses and we're growing them short and we're using them for, you know, human activities for the most part.
So, David, no doubt you've seen significant changes in turf management practices over the years. And I know from attending a class, you've always taught respect for the environment in turf care. Could you tell us about some of the biggest changes you've seen?
Sure. You know, being around for 33 years, I'm getting to be the old timer, but there have been a lot of changes in that time. The first one I always think of is that we have a no phosphorus and lawn fertilizer law that came about in 2012 in New York State. And that basically said we're not supposed to be putting phosphorus on lawns that are receiving fertilizer. With a few caveats, if you're starting a new lawn, you can still use a fertilizer, like a starter fertilizer that has phosphorus. Or if you have a soil test that says you need phosphorus, but that law hopefully is working to reduce phosphorus runoff into waterways, lakes, places like that. So that's a big one. Certainly the grasses themselves have been changing. There are people called turf grass breeders, and they've been working to make grasses that grow slower, grasses that are better tolerant to drought, grasses that are more pest tolerant, grasses that need less fertilizer. So the industry, if I can call it that, and the research is really moving towards more sustainable lawns because the grasses themselves are changing. I think people are interested very much in low-mow lawns, no-mow lawns, lawn mowers that are not going to be as polluting. So that's a big change, and we're moving in that direction. I think we have more alternative, what I call alternative practices, rather than just going to the store and buying a bag of fertilizer and a bag of grub control and just putting it on sort of mindlessly. There's been a lot of work on trying to figure out how we can use less pesticides, how can we use products more effectively, things like overseeding, which I've been working on for a long time, reducing the amount of herbicide that people use. There's new management things for grubs coming along, which is great. So, you know, back in 1989, some people wanted that stuff and we just didn't have it. And now we have more alternatives like that. And the last one, which is really very new, is that we have genetically engineered grasses coming along. So that's going to be very interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you just mentioned in terms of chemical overuse? Because I know certainly when you drive by like golf courses and they're just so pristine, I always feel like they're pouring, you know, huge amounts of chemicals. And a lot of my neighbors, I think, put a lot of chemicals on their lawns. Talk a little bit about that and kind of what kind of education's out there and what the trends are and what people seem to be doing in terms of that.
Sure. Well, you know, the world is geared to marketing, right? People buy what they see. People buy what they know. There's a lot of money that is behind lawn care products. So, you know, something like a step program that tells people to, you know, put these things on in this order and you're going to have results. That is really attractive to people because it's sort of easy to do. It's in front of them. It's at the store. They don't have to think about it a lot. So, you know, we're asking them to step back, to think about your lawn, to understand what's going on in your lawn. And that takes a lot more work. So we're kind of up against that marketing and sort of ease factor. But I take hope in that people like Master Gardeners and certainly a lot of concerned people that, you know, have a lawn, but they don't want to make it something that is going to be detrimental to the environment. They want to be more environmentally friendly. They're the ones that are really looking for, you know, the information that is a little more involved. And certainly I want to say golf course people have changed a tremendous amount too. There's a huge interest among golf people of being more environmentally friendly. So I think that's a big change too. You know, they're under pressure to have good turf grass because that's what they need to have. But there's a lot of folks that want to do alternatives. So I think the message is getting out there. I would like it to happen faster. But it is changing. So I take heart in that, I guess.
I don't know if this is alternative or not, but my lawn, I basically mow the weeds. It's one of those things where I don't think I've ever put fertilizer on my lawn and I don't think I've ever put herbicides. So is there anything wrong with that? I mean, it looks like grass. It's not beautiful, but I know there's a lot of kind of what you would call weeds, clover certainly, that's pollen and nectar for the bees, and there's plantains. Is there anything wrong with my just doing kind of nothing?
No. If you came to my lawn, I would call it a weed test laboratory because I have every weed known to man. I'm a big fan of clover because I'm a beekeeper. I think those lawns are fine. If that's, you know, what you want, to me, that's okay. The only caveats I would say with something like that would be if you have a lot of crabgrass and then that crabgrass dies in the fall and you have bare ground over the winter. That's a source of erosion and nutrient runoff. So we like to see really dense lawns because dense lawns hold the nutrients. They slow down the water. So areas that sort of go bare with crabgrass or annual weeds, I'm not really thinking that's helping the environment. I would rather see dense growth there. So that, you know, it's actually probably more environmentally friendly. So sometimes doing a little bit like fertilizing your lawn and having it denser may actually be better than having a lawn that really is causing, you know, or allowing nutrients to run off. So, but I think, you know, there shouldn't be any pressure involved. I always run across people that live in upscale housing and there's this pressure to have a beautiful lawn or to try to achieve that. And I don't like social pressure. I don't think people should do that to each other. So I don't subscribe to the social aspects of lawn care.
So we noticed that there's a push to plant more naturalized landscapes and alternatives to green grass lawns. Could you tell us a little bit about some IPM practices people could use instead?
Well, as far as if you want to have a lawn and you want to take care of it, I would say, you know, do a soil test, learn what your nutrient levels are. If you need phosphorus, you might need to add it, but you probably don't need to add phosphorus. But the soil test tells you a lot of interesting information for any kind of gardening. So I'm a huge fan of soil tests. So contact your county cooperative extension office and they can help you with that. That's kind of step one. The overseeding, which is something we've worked on a lot, is just using grass seed, especially perennial ryegrass or tall fescue, and putting that down in the fall several times. And that will increase the density of the lawn. That will cover up the bare spots. And then the next year, you're going to have more grass. And it also works to crowd out the crabgrass. Crabgrass is probably the number one weed that is in New York State lawns and people put on pre-emergent herbicide in the spring. So we would like to get them to use grass seed in the fall, build up the density of the lawn. Then you don't need to use the pre-emergent herbicide. And that's something that Cornell people, Iowa State, and me, we've been kind of the three people that have been pushing that. And that's actually starting to get out in the mainstream. So I think that's really exciting. That's my top tip, really, for IPM sort of a lawn. And then, you know, if you have grubs, we have some alternative methods for controlling those. Chinch bugs are a problem that come along. We have grasses that are chinch bug resistant. So, you know, if you have a really bad chinch bug problem, maybe you need to use an insecticide, but then don't plant the same old grass. Try to find the chinch bug resistant grasses, use the genetics, and then you'll probably have less chinch bugs in the future. So there's a lot of little tricks like that. Now, that, of course, that's not marketed out there and that's not sold easily in the store, but we can help people with those sorts of things.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, June the 19th, 2023. I'm Mike Clifford. Today marks a historic chapter in American history for black people. On this date, 1865, slaves in Texas learned they were free from servitude. That happened more than 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
The name, Juneteenth, is a combination of the month and date when Union Army General Gordon Granger made the announcement in Galveston. Eunice Trotter is director of the Indiana Landmarks Black Heritage Preservation Program. She says the historic date has an Indiana connection.
Indiana's United States Colored Troops 28 went to Galveston, Texas, and at gunpoint, in many cases, forced the release of African Americans.
By the 1860s, Indiana had more than 60 black settlements. The official name for the holiday is Juneteenth, National Independence Day. It is celebrated with family-themed festivals, parades, plays, poetry readings, and more. President Joe Biden signed the bill creating the holiday into law in 2021. I'm Terry D. reporting.
Now from CBS News, one person was fatally shot and at least 22 others injured in gunfire that broke out during a Juneteenth celebration in Illinois Sunday morning. The mass shooting happened in Willowbrook, a suburban village about 20 miles west of Chicago, where a large crowd of young people had gathered for a party in a parking lot near Route 83. That's a major state highway. Meantime, a new training program is turning to teens to get their peers connected to the resources they might need to turn things around.
One in five teens in the U.S. will experience a mental health challenge before they turn 18, but 64% of them won't seek help. A new training program is turning to teens to get their peers connected to the resources they need to turn things around. Betsy Mulgano with Mental Health First Aid Colorado says young people are in a unique position to identify warning signs. Maybe someone they know has been withdrawing from friends, or they used to enjoy soccer and now they aren't showing up for practice.
You're not diagnosing this person. You're just kind of noticing a change in behavior or appearance. The training's supposed to help kids feel more comfortable to approach someone to be like, hey, I've noticed that there's a change in your typical behavior. Do you want to talk about it? Is everything okay?
According to the 2021 Healthy Kids Colorado survey, nearly 40% of high school students said they experienced symptoms of depression in the last year, and 17% said they had seriously considered suicide. Suicide is the third leading cause of death for kids aged 15 to 19. I'm Eric Galatis.
This is Public News Service. Private colleges and universities across Massachusetts have a more than $70 billion annual impact on the Commonwealth. That's according to a new report.
The Association of Independent Colleges and Universities in Massachusetts finds its 59 schools generate more than $2 billion in tax revenues and support more than 300,000 jobs. Association President Rob McCarran says the schools are a talent pipeline for the Commonwealth's growing biotech and healthcare industries.
They are why companies come here, why companies grow here. It is that year after year infusion of talented students that come out of all of these colleges and universities.
McCarran says schools like Elms College in Western Massachusetts are working to grow the diversity of the state's teaching workforce, while several others, including Regis College outside Boston, are helping to alleviate the statewide shortage of nurses. I'm Catherine Carley reporting.
Massachusetts high school students are benefiting from more than $700 million in grants and scholarships. The latest NEKC Foundation's Kids Count data book shows Kentucky ranks in the bottom tier nationwide for overall child well-being.
Terry Brooks with Kentucky Youth Advocates explains Kentucky's childhood poverty rate had been declining for the last several years. But he says the new findings reveal a troubling reversal in poverty trends and other indicators of a thriving childhood.
When we look at the measures in economic well-being and education and health and community and family, the overall picture shows that not only are we falling behind other states, but we're falling behind Kentucky's own track record.
The report also highlights the nation's widespread lack of affordable and accessible child care. Kentucky's average child care center cost for toddlers in 2021 was around $7,000 per year, or 27% of a single mom's income. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
Advocates say more federal funding is needed to ensure these programs continue to reach those who need them the most. Finally, Suzanne Potter lets us know conservation groups are encouraging people to speak out at a virtual hearing tomorrow.
A company called Golden State Natural Resources, made up of county supervisors from rural counties, says it wants to reduce the fuel load in national forests by removing what they call excess biomass. Laura Height with the Partnership for Policy Integrity says forest thinning does not protect nearby homes and adds that dead or burned trees should be left in place because they sequester carbon.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for starting a week with Public News Service, member and listener supported. Here is a great radio station, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We continue our series on dark money today, focusing on limited liability corporations, or LLCs, commonly used for organizing small businesses. But LLCs can also be used to hide political donations from the public. In most states, other than the original corporate registration, LLCs are not required to disclose their member shareholders. The IRS treats LLCs as a partnership. So for a federal candidate campaign donation, each shareholder of the LLC must account for it in their $3,300 maximum contribution. Instead, in federal races, LLCs are more often used to funnel money to super PACs, where only the LLC's name needs to be reported. There, the money can get bundled to buy negative ads or other activities in support of a campaign. For state races in over half of the country, LLCs can make contributions directly to candidates. In some states, this means unlimited contributions, and in others, the individual limit with no requirement to disclose shareholders. LLCs can also contribute to PACs, super PACs, and dark money groups. So in most states, LLCs are used so voters won't really know who's behind the money influencing their elections. A few states, like Arizona and New York, are attempting to force LLCs to disclose their members' donations, trying to close what's called the LLC loophole. More on that in our next report. We have detailed explainers and resources at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Interesting, boring, really boring, really wonderful things.
It'd be about
chocolate pigs.
She's obsessed with pigs.
Chocolate pigs?
Awesome.
The way down.
I turned it down.
Only dogs can hear.
I turned it down.
Do it.
Did you hear that?
No.
We'll be right back.
Wave Farms Art Park is now open on Saturdays. Drop in for unannounced guided tours on Saturdays from noon to 6 p.m. or book a tour in advance on other days. Wave Farms' 29-acre campus in Acre is the home of the Art Park with 13 installations in the Study Center, the WGXC Acre Studio, and the Wave Farms International Artist Residency Program. Visitors on Saturdays receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free and tours typically last 60 to 90 minutes. Again, on Saturdays, Wave Farms Art Park is open for drop-in visits anytime from noon to 6 p.m. from June through October. Stop by Wave Farm on Saturdays from noon to 6 p.m.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined by Sean Collins, who is a union representative and organizer for SEIU Local 200 United, and he's been particularly the point person on the effort to organize a union at Capital Roots, which had initially voluntarily recognized a union, but since then there's been increase in problems, a lot of turnover, a lot of layoffs, and recently Capital Roots and Amy Klein had notified that they were trying to withdraw union representation. Apparently recently the National Labor Relations Board, Region 3, has indicated they have found merit to the many unfair labor practices charges filed by the union against Capital Roots, though a complaint itself has not yet been filed. Sean, what else should we know about the present situation?
Yes, I mean, you know, first of all, thank you for taking the time to follow up on this. I mean, what folks should know is that, like, the board has, you know, determined that there's merit in the vast majority of charges that we filed. against Capital Roots and specifically regarding Amy Klein, the CEO's conduct. You know, they've determined that there is merit to our charges that she engaged in unlawful activity. They're retaliating against employees, threatening employees, surveilling employees, engaging in disparate enforcement of policies. And in the case of, one employee, unlawfully retaliated against them for their union organizing activities. It's unfortunate, that it's come to this, and it's unfortunate that it's taken so long for the NLRB to investigate this. But I think it also shows just the scope of unlawful, activities that Amy and her management team engaged in. And, we're glad that it's finally, that the determination has finally landed. It confirms what we've known all along. But at the same time, all the workers who were a part of the initial organizing drive just over a year ago don't work there anymore. It's too late to undo the impact this has had on the organization and most importantly, the communities that it serves.
So that's one of the points, that Amy Klein has been making. Well, everybody's left. The people who signed the union cards aren't there anymore. The few workers we got, don't necessarily embrace the union at this point. That's why we were drawing recognition. Does that, carry any weight with the National Labor Relations Board?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the board hasn't, it's begun its investigation into the what we argue is an unlawful withdrawal of recognition, but it absolutely will color that investigation because, as with the other charges that we filed, they found that there was merit in those charges, but yet she, unlawfully withdrew recognition along with making other unilateral changes to people's employment in an environment where there was unremedied unfair labor practices. Her decision to withdraw recognition, is just flagrantly unlawful. And regarding the current employees who are there, they're working in an environment where these issues have not been addressed, and now the board, has found merit in them, and hopefully, we're continuing to have conversations with folks, and we really do hope to reestablish a bargaining relationship, if there can be one. But the onus is on Amy. She's the one who's been just, left and right, just breaking the law. She can't seem to help herself.
Now, these union organizing drive seem to take a very long time, particularly from the point, even after the union is recognized, to actually getting, a written agreement, labor agreement with the employer. Why does that take so long? Does the law need to be changed to speed up this process?
Well, it does take a long time. And yes, I do think that there are necessary changes in labor law that would hopefully speed up the collective bargaining process. But the way the law currently works is that, they have to meet a very basic obligation, meet and confer, bargaining good faith. But the law doesn't say that there is a timeline in terms of reaching a first agreement. There's no binding arbitration in that process. People are of different minds as to whether that'd be good or bad, but at least it would result in a conclusion, in a settlement, even if it's not maybe the most desirable one. Whereas right now, Amy and other nonprofit executives, she's not unique in this regard, not just in the Capital District, but nationwide, drag the process out of the bargaining table. And that obviously has an effect on morale. Because the issues that folks wanted to address at the bargaining table through the bargaining process can't, because employers drag out the process. And so, we need reforms there. And then I would say also too, we need reforms in labor law that would actually put like harsher punishments on those managers and supervisors and that violate the law. Like right now, there's really no punitive damages. They might have to pay like back pay. The worst they might have to do is pay back pay and reinstate somebody. But beyond that, there's no punitive damages like there is for vast majority of other crimes, for when you engage in like flagrant lawbreaking like she has.
Now, I will know that Hudson Mohawk Magazine has several times reached out to Ms. Klein and Capital Roots Management to offer them the opportunity to speak with us. So far, they have not taken, been willing to have that sort of public discussion. Now, you mentioned that you've been notified that the Labor Relations Board has found merit, but they've not issued a complaint yet. You know, what is the timeline for that? And sort of a second related question, given that, you know, that apparently, you know, everybody who initially wanted to form the union has left, what has been your ability as a union to actually meet with the newer employees to begin to educate them, you know, why their former colleagues wanted a union?
Right, right. Well, in terms of the complaint that, you know, we hope it will be, you know, issued here soon, you know, before the end of the summer. At the very least, you know, but we'll see. In terms of the current employees, you know, the employer hasn't provided us any information on the folks who are part of the bargaining unit. So we don't know. We've had limited contact with them. We're trying to, you know, connect with them, and trying to, you know, sort of address and the concerns that they might have. But you know, it's you know, I think it's, again, you know, Amy has poisoned the well here and made it seem like, you know, the union, you know, its members, you know, were, you know, set out to basically engage in like character defamation and you know, impugn Amy's reputation. But, you know, that's her ego speaking. We were hoping to address the concerns that we had, you know, a safe, you know, a healthy work-life balance, you know, decent pay, you know, better working conditions, and a seat at the table is what the workers set out to do. It's unfortunate that Amy took it all personally, but that seems to be par for the course.
Is there any evidence that the board of, you know, Capital Roots has tried to, you know, at least say, come on, you know, we need to sit down, we need to get this resolved, this is not, you know, a good image for us? You know, what has sort of been the overall, you know, larger community reaction to the situation?
I mean, we've had incredible support from the community and from volunteers and supporters of Capital Roots, you know, many of whom have stopped volunteering and providing, you know, that their support to the organization until it changes its tune. I mean, we really appreciate that. And we understand that, you know, people, you know, this is an organization that's been around for nearly 50 years. I live around the corner from one of its, you know, one of the community gardens. It's an incredible organization. And that's, you know, really part of the DNA of the region. And I think people would like to, you know, reinvest their time and energies into its important work. But I think, you know, Amy's actions are in the way of them being comfortable with doing that. We hope that the board will see the NLRB's determination that Amy specifically, in many instances, broke the law, and will take action, you know, to address this. And we think that they should ask her to resign. She's responsible near single-handedly for the impact on its reputation. The workers who were there, they, you know, they didn't get into this work looking to make, you know, make a bunch of money or anything like that. They were really passionate about the mission of the organization and its work. And they wanted to make it better and strengthen it. And Amy was too proud, egotistical, choose whichever you think is appropriate, to let them have that seat at the table. It's unfortunate.
We're out of time. Sean Collins, organizer at SEIU Local 200 United, talking about Capital Roots Union organizing effort. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Welcome to Trekking the Trails. I'm Heidi Bach, Director of Land Stewardship and Community Partnerships with the Columbia Land Conservancy. And this month, we'll be visiting Borden's Pond Conservation Area, a 62-acre property on Route 66, just outside the village of Chatham. This site has nearly 1.6 miles of forested trails, a small wetland meadow, and a seasonal stream. Borden's is home to a variety of wildlife that inhabits the forest and seasonal stream. At the right time of year, there are Catskill Mountain views from the top of the Tamarack Trail. For this trek, we'll be walking along the Streamside Trail, which follows an unnamed stream and takes us through a deciduous forest consisting mostly of oak and maple and shagbark hickory trees. But we won't be looking at the trees so much as looking down, as Borden's is an excellent place for spotting spring ephemerals. These are early woodland wildflowers that show up sometimes when there's even still a little snow left on the ground, and offer a much-needed pop of color after a long winter. Even though they are only around for a short time, they play a critical role in the forest ecosystem. They thrive on the forest floor, where there is a lot of moisture from melting snow and decomposing leaf litter. Many insects that are waking up around the same time use these spring flowers and seeds as an important food source, especially some of our native pollinators and ant species. Many of these flowers have been up since early to mid-April, but are still flowering now, especially depending on the weather. If it's cooler, the flowers will hang on longer, but you'll want to get out there soon so you don't miss them. I'll talk about the common species we'll find at Borden's, and we'll link to some identification resources in the show notes. The first one is red trillium. This is a common red flower in moist deciduous forest. It has three petals that poke up above three diamond-shaped leaves. It's usually crimson-red, but some patches have white or yellow-green flowers. The solitary flower has an unpleasant odor that attracts carrion flies that act as pollinators. Next, we have the wood anemone, which has small pink or white flowers that are about 4 inches tall that poke up above their leaves. They can form patches along woodland borders, and their flowers can appear to tremble in the breeze, giving them the nickname wind flowers. Next, we have trout lily, which can be found in sizable colonies and is one of the most recognizable species. Its leaves, said to look like the markings of a brook trout, and often appear about the same time as trout fishing season. They have a nodding yellow flower, which doesn't stay around as long as their signature leaves. Next, we have Jack in the Pulpit, which has three leaflets, often found in wetter areas along floodplains or wetlands, and can get up to 2 feet tall when fully grown. The blossoms appear at the same height as the leaves, with a large, cylindrical, hooded flower that is green with maroon stripes. The flower mimics that of a pitcher plant, but is not carnivorous. And finally, we have wild geranium. This is well known for its large, deeply lobed leaves and showy pink or purple five-petaled flowers. They can grow in dense colonies, about 18 to 24 inches tall, and are also known as the spotted crane's bill because of the seed capsule, which resembles a crane head and beak. For more than 30 years, the Columbia Land Conservancy has worked to inspire our community to more deeply connect with, respect, and protect the natural world. We collaborate with partners and volunteers to improve the health of the land, ensure a thriving farm economy, create environmental education opportunities, and provide access to the outdoors. We also support municipal leaders in conservation-minded decision-making. To learn more, visit clhctrust.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram.
WGXC has a new call-in number for anyone to leave a 3-minute message that we will play back on the air. Listeners can leave as many 3-minute audio letters to the editor at 518-212-7509 as they want, and WGXC will let your voice be heard on the local airwaves. The number again to call in and record a 3-minute message that will be played back on 90.7 FM is 518-212-7509. From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that former WGXC programmer Alan Skerritt, who died in January, will be honored at this year's Juneteenth celebration in Hudson on June 17th. Tanya Jackson, the Juneteenth lead organizer, said, and I quote, "He was the director of the Mental Health Association for years. He spread the importance of the NAACP when we had an active chapter. He had a radio show for years. He left a hole in the heart of the community when he passed. We will have a memorial display of artifacts from history and a moment of remembrance for him as well," end quote. Skerritt was the head of the local chapter of the NAACP. Juneteenth is a federal holiday commemorating the emancipation of enslaved African Americans in the United States. The Juneteenth celebration in Hudson includes a street party, exhibitions and performances, and is sponsored by Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition. Jackson said, and I quote, "We have a kids' zone and we have games and activities for adults,